Hi, this is Amy.
And this is Andrew, and in this episode, AADL talks to Bruce Conforth about the John Sinclair Freedom Rally.
Rob talks with University of Michigan Professor of American Culture Bruce Conforth about the cultural and historical significance of the John Sinclair Freedom Rally, in particular, John Lennon's decision to appear. He also talks about the role Ann Arbor played in the 1960s.
Last weekend, I gave my students in my one class an assignment. It's my annual 60s challenge, because my contention is, you know, because students always ask me, you know, how come we don't have, you know, movements and stuff like you guys had in the 60s today? And, you know, the standard answer always used to be, well, there was the draft, there was the war, you know, there were all these things. Those were important, but I've come to the decision that I don't think they were as important as the fact that we didn't have distractions. There was nothing to do but hang out. And when you hang out, you have the basis for subculture. When you have a bazillion distractions, you know, so they had to go through the weekend, or they had to try to go through the weekend without anything that didn't exist in the 60s, which meant, of course, no cell phone, no computer. They could use a computer, but they had to use it only as a typewriter. Mm-hmm. Of course, no access to the internet in any way, no ATM or credit card. Mm-hmm. They could listen to a CD, but only in their house on a CD player, because it had to become a record player.
Right.
Which means they couldn't listen to music outside of the house. No MP3 players.
Nothing. No headphones.
No headphones.
Yep.
None of that stuff.
It's very interesting.
If they watched television, they actually had to watch it on a television.
How about they
could only watch CBS, NBC, ABC, or PBS.
Yes.
They could only watch one of the four channels.
Right.
If they wanted to watch a movie, they had to either go to a movie or watch it on TV, because they couldn't rent a movie in any format, because it didn't exist. But, you know, I mean, when you don't have those things, Xerox machines didn't even exist. I mean, think about that. We think about Xerox machines as being around forever. Xerox machines didn't exist. You used to have to, you wanted to run something
Mimeograph.
Off. Mimeo or Gestetner machine. And so, you know, if you take away all that stuff, and this is the point of the experiment, you take away all that stuff, the point is to see what the students do in lieu of that stuff. And ultimately, they say, well, we ended out hanging out and making up our own entertainment. And damn it, there it is.
Discussions.
There's the basis for the sub and culture counterculture.
That is interesting. I like that.
It's just we didn't have distractions. There's too much stuff distracting us from the things that that are important.
I'm trying to think of this as a kind of a good setup question. But I guess I should put it simply as possible. Why was the Free John Sinclair concert important in the context of American history or even music history?
Well, any number of reasons. Number one, it was one of the first times that, you know, a major cultural icon like John Lennon came to the aid of a particular individual. Now, shortly before that, you had George Harrison, doing the concert for Bangladesh. So there had always been benefit concerts. But this was one of the first times when you have a major icon coming to serve a political purpose for a specific individual and a very specific cause that really relates to a relatively small number of people. We're not trying to save a country. We're not trying to cure a disease. We're trying to get this guy out of jail, you know, and trying to legalize marijuana, basically. So the cultural context was very, very different. And to do it in a place like Ann Arbor was remarkably important, because Ann Arbor had become really a countercultural nexus at the time, as you probably know. I mean, hippies had taken over the city council. Possession of marijuana had been, you know, reduced to a $5 ticket. So Ann Arbor was a really interesting town at the time, because at the same time that it was incredibly liberal on the one hand, that liberalism also caused a tremendous amount of focus to be placed on its attention. Probably for every hippie that there was in Ann Arbor, there was at least one, you know, federal narcotics agent or, you know, some aspect of the man. And to do the kind of thing that John Lennon did at Chrysler Arena, bringing together not only rock stars, but, you know, members of the Chicago 7, political leaders, such diverse artists as Pete Seeger and Stevie Wonder, Commander Cody and the Lost Planet Airmen, David Peel on the Lower East Side, just a real vast panoply of cultural members of the counterculture from the 50s on up to the present time. It was a remarkable moment, but not without, you know, I have to say, not without a certain amount of non-altruistic interests on Lennon's behalf. You know, John, like many geniuses, had great ideas, and I do consider him, you know, one of the few geniuses that I've ever met in my life. But, you know, he had great ideas, was willing to devote time and effort to a lot of causes, but also, you know, had somewhere in the back of his head, you know, well, what can I do to get something out of this? Not necessarily in a bad way, but how is this going to work into my scheme of things? It's not just how am I going to accomplish freeing John Sinclair? How is this going to set me up in where I want to be? And so, you know, the concert was about a lot of things. It wasn't just about, you know, freeing John Sinclair. It was about John Lennon's agenda. It was about the politics of Ann Arbor at the moment. It was about the politics of America at the moment. It really covered a lot of bases.
Ivan, your friend and my friend actually was working for ABCO at the time. You might have told him. Right. And when we did an interview with him, he described John as kind of politically naive. That he really had no idea what he was stepping into, and B, that he was easily persuaded by that Abbie Hoffman and Jerry Rubin.
Well, it was Jerry Rubin, yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, John, and that's what I was talking about, you know, about John's character. You know, when John and Yoko took up residence down in Bank Street, you know, this was, you know, at the beginning of when the efforts were started to be made to keep him under surveillance and to try to get him out of the country. And, you know, he suddenly gets involved with a whole cadre of really crazy-ass people. I mean, there's almost no other way to say it. You know, like David Peel on the Lower East Side. You know, David Peel, you know, was famous, if you can call him that, at the time, for putting out a couple of records. One, you know, Have a Marijuana, and the other song was the Pope Smokes Dope. You know, not really one of the great political thinkers of our time, but, you know, part of that guerrilla street revolutionary politics that was so common at the time. You know, you didn't have to be good. You didn't have to be smart. You know, you just got out there and made a scene. And David Peel was one of those characters. And John hooks up with him because John sees, you know, this guy doing this thing on the street and thinks, this is very cool, you know. Yeah, John was very impressionable. John was very naive. And this is not the kind of stuff that he's used to seeing coming from his background. You know, here's this guy on the street singing songs about marijuana and being, you know, spouting this quasi-revolutionary rhetoric, playing with an ad hoc band, basically a jug band, homemade instruments, washtub basses and stuff. You can almost see the kind of romance that John Lennon would have seen in something like that. He would have seen it kind of like almost as you know, if as a Western academic, I would say, you know, he could have seen it as, you know, the great voice of the American proletariat. I don't think John Lennon would have put it in those terms, but it would have served that purpose for him. Here's the voice of the young revolutionary on the street. And then Jerry Rubin enters the picture, and, you know, Jerry has already established himself quite well. And Jerry really plays an extraordinarily pivotal role. I mean, Jerry is really the one who gets John heavily involved in this whole idea of countercultural revolution. On top of that, Lennon had really been taken, like I said, by George Harrison's Concert for Bangladesh. He just thought that this was like one of the greatest things. And you got to remember the Beatles hadn't played. John hadn't played in America since 1966, their farewell concert at Candlestick Park. So that was the last time. So it had been 5 years. And here Harrison does this great thing, you know, and John wants to perform. John wants to be a performer. And so largely based on Rubin's influence of this political idea, David Peel's influence of the guerrilla street theater, and the success of Harrison's Bangladesh concert, John puts together this idea that he's going to put together a revolutionary cross-country tour that's going to be filmed and recorded, and it's going to be this big thing, and it's going to end up in San Diego, which at that time was where the Republican convention was going to be that year. And he saw it as being, you know, this cross-country journey to finally bring the showdown, you know, between him and Nixon, you know, because, you know, he'd be there, you know, performing in San Diego roughly at the same time that Nixon would be at the San Diego Republican Convention. Of course, the Republican Convention gets moved to Miami for reasons that had nothing to do with Lennon. It had much more to do with finances and some rather skeezy California politics. But, you know, John had this you know, this great plan, you know, to do this. And he, you know, he had enlisted Eric Clapton, you know, who part of the Plastic Ono band and all that. And they're gonna do this cross-country thing. So when Jerry Rubin, you know, told John about the John Sinclair concert, well, this was the perfect setup. And this is where I'm talking about, you know, John's combination of doing something altruistic, but also what's in it for him. You know, the Chrysler Arena concert is an opportunity for him to say, all right, well, let's see what we can put together. Let's see what kind of film crew we can put together. Let's see what kind of sound crew we can get to put together. And let's use this as a testing ground for this great cross-country trip that we're going to want to take. So in many ways, the Chrysler Arena concert for John Lennon was as important as a test vehicle for his own goals as it was to go there and to help free John Sinclair.
Well, let's take a step back for a moment, because I think, doesn't this kind of go along with the fact that John, for the longest time, couldn't come to terms with the fact that he was a Beatle, and that he was, you know, that his fame, that,
oh, yeah,
the,
of course.
And that the fame drove him crazy, and he hated not being able to, you know, walk out on the street and everything like that. And then with stuff like, you know, the bed piece and everything like that, it was kind of, well, I'm going to use my celebrity as something good. Does that kind of go along with that kind of transformation?
Yes, and I, of course it does, and you know, I don't mean to put John down in any way, because I like millions of other people of our generation, you know, loved John Lennon, but you know, there's a certain narcissism, you know, in bed piece, you know, we're gonna sit in bed, you guys got to come to us, you know, look at us, you know, there's a certain. If John really, you know, loathed celebrity, then you don't do those kinds of things. You don't do public things that are going to draw, particularly odd public things, that are going to draw more attention to you. You try to make yourself less conspicuous, not more conspicuous. So, yeah, John did try to use his cultural, you know, cachet for purposes that he thought were important, but... You know, I have to believe that there was a certain part of him, you know, that was just relishing the attention that was being heaped upon him at the same time.
Tom Hayden in that Phil Oakes film that we both saw divided the 60s into two, and I think that's something he's commonly done, where the first part of the 60s is the idealism and... you know, we're going to change the world and everything like that. And then the second part of the 60s, which goes into the 70s, is when everything kind of degenerates. We're not going to change the world. And things like the weather, you know, the weather underground, SDS, Kent State and everything, like, things are starting to deteriorate.
Yeah. And John Lennon comes out, and, you know, I mean, you may, other people may have said this already, but I mean, the first thing he says when he comes out at 3 o'clock in the morning, after all these other people had played, I mean, the first thing he comes out is he says, "Okay, so flower power failed. So what? We start over again." And that was probably the most important thing. I think that was his most important contribution to that entire concert. You know, okay, yes, singing, you know, the Luck of the Irish, and, you know, singing, you know, his John Sinclair song, great, you know, terrific, the appearance and everything. But for him to admit and to try to get the assembled multitude to say, "Look, folks, we had a good run at it. It didn't work. We got to try something different." That's a remarkable statement for any culture to say. We failed. Mm-hmm. We got to do something different. You know, Martin Luther King was never able to say that. And I think that that's one of the things that drew displeasure towards him among certain factions within the African-American community. You know, towards the end of Martin Luther King's life, there were a great number of African-Americans who were very disenchanted with Dr. King because he kept after, you know, and you got to give him credit. You know, again, this is not a knock on Dr. King, you know. I think the fact that he kept to his principles are absolutely astounding. But there were a lot of people who said, you know, "Look, we've tried now and this is not working." Anytime a culture, you know, can actually get to a point where it says, or its leaders say, "We had a really good idea, folks. It didn't work the way we wanted to. We got to change. Now we have to do something different." That, you know, we can talk from you know, academic perspectives, you know, like somebody like anthropologist Victor Turner, who talks about the dramatic elements within the life cycle of a community: breach, crisis, redress, and integration. You know, and what we see being played out in that one moment is exactly that life cycle. You know, Lennon is coming out there. He's recognizing publicly the breach. The breach is flower power didn't work. The crisis is we have to do something different. And so what's the redress? We need to start over again. A very powerful moment in the cultural history of the late 60s, early 70s, of the counterculture. Big, big moment when he says that.
What do you think he had in mind? Was it these concerts? Was it this thing?
Yeah, I think what he had in mind was largely based upon what people like Rubin and Sinclair and Bobby Seale and David Dellinger and Rennie Davis and all of those people, you know, who were his close advisors at that time. I think what he had in mind was, yeah, to do this revolution, take it to the streets, you know. That was the idea of the cross-country tour. You know, in the 60s we had that saying, bringing the war home. You know, bringing the war home was all about literally bringing realization of the war, and in some senses, the violence of the war, the protest of the war, back to the streets of America, so that it wasn't just this thing that was taking place, you know, a couple thousand miles away, you know, that we only saw on television. It was bringing it home in a very real way. And I think John's idea at that point probably was to take this new revolutionary ethic to the street in the form of music, not take it there in the form of the kind of protests that we saw at the Chicago Convention or things, but to take it as a revolutionary message to the streets of America on his tour across the country.
Just to provide maybe a little bit background, how much do you think a lot of this had to do with the amendment that lowered the voting age to 18?
You know, that's an interesting question. I'm sure that it made major changes. I would have to see the demographics. Offhand, I don't know whether a really significant or statistically significant number of 18-year-olds voted. Maybe they did, maybe they didn't. I don't know those statistics. But ideologically, it had a change, because ideologically, it said, you know, we now have power that we didn't have before. So even if those 18-year-olds didn't vote, they knew that they were now part of the power brokerage of American culture, of the fabric of American politics. And that in and of, you know, just that idea is a powerful force. You know, believing that you're empowered doesn't mean you have to do anything about it, but it allows you to walk out on the street with a different attitude. It allows you to conduct your daily life in a different way. It allows you to have a different perspective on who you are in society. So whether or not those people actually voted, I don't know. But clearly it had an impact on their self-identity.
The film U.S. versus John Lennon talks about the fact that, you know, there was maybe one person who could have influenced the 18 to 21 demographic, and it was John Lennon.
Of course.
And which leads to the question, of course, you know, we had Richard Nixon in the background thinking, oh, my God, what is John Lennon going to do to me? And it almost seems, even though he took it to the extreme, it almost seems logical that he would feel threatened by John Lennon and would
But that also you know, instills a certain paranoia in John that you know is going to ultimately impact the outcome of the 10 for 2 concert, you know, because after the concert is over and after the 10 for 2 film is being made and everything, you know, John and Yoko had originally agreed to give John and Lenny, I don't know whether it was $10,000 or $20,000, some amount of money, and that was when the pressure was really getting heavy on John as far as being deported, and when John and Lenny went to see John and Yoko to get the money. Well, you know, John waffled and waffled and waffled and made them wait, literally made them wait, I think, 2 hours before they could be seen, you know. And so here's another example of John, you know, using his celebrity. You know, you got to wait, you know, we're not ready to see you yet. You know, we're going to wait. You have to wait. When John and Lenny were finally brought in before John and Yoko, John basically said nothing because apparently they had worked it out, where Yoko would just said, you know, well, we've decided that the plight of women is more important, and so we're donating, instead of giving the money to you, we're giving all the money to, you know, to women's causes. And they basically wrote you know, John and Lenny off. Largely because John was scared, he was terrified that if he made this financial contribution to Sinclair, that this would be just yet another thing that could be held against him to prevent him from getting his green card. It would be just another thing that could be used, you know, that here is this guy, you know, this foreigner, you know, giving all this money to this convicted, albeit overturned, but this convicted drug felon, anarchist, political revolutionary, somebody we don't want in this country.
How immediate was he feeling the repercussions of this, and how much of it was imagined and how much of it was real?
I'd be willing to bet that he started to feel it relatively soon after the concert, because the concert really made a huge splash, obviously. The concert made national news. I mean, nothing like that had ever been done before. And the context of the concert was so crazy. I mean, you know, besides it going on forever and featuring, you know, all these incredibly diverse stars, I mean Chrysler Arena, I mean, there was so much dope being smoked in Chrysler Arena that I'm surprised, you know, the place actually stayed on the ground, you know, because there were marijuana dealers just like, you know, if you go to a sporting event now, you know, there's people walking up and down, you know, selling pop and popcorn and stuff like that. I mean, there were dealers walking up and down the aisles with bricks of marijuana, you know, breaking off pieces and selling them. I mean, I doubt whether there had ever been, maybe never been since, a single building in the state of Michigan, maybe in the United States, where in one concise time so much marijuana was consumed. So this and everybody knew this, you know, and so the context that John Lennon left that concert with was one that, well, holy shit, look what just happened, you know. There were 20,000 people, you know, getting stoned as anything. There were, you know, people like Bobby Seale, you know, from the Black Panthers, making these incredibly incendiary speeches. Even Allen Ginsberg, you know, spoke out in a more political way than he was used to. you have all this stuff going on. The repercussions for this could be really profound. So I'd be willing to bet that it wasn't too long after that. Because I'm sure he had all those same people, you know, the Bobby Seales and the Jerry Rubins, you know, saying to him, yeah, what a great job you did. What a great job you did. You know, we gave it to him. We showed them. We showed them. Yeah, but if we showed them, the man was watching. And so we just brought a whole lot more attention on ourselves in a lot of different ways. So I any paranoia that Lennon might have exhibited following that, I don't think it would have solely just been imagined. I think a lot of it probably would have been very justified, because this was, as you said, you know, who can speak to the 18 to 24 people better than John Lennon can? And with an event like the Chrysler Arena concert, you know, Nixon is going to say, this man is a danger, you know. I mean, he really, this is proof what a danger he can be. We have to do something about him, you know. And I can only imagine, since his tapes have been released, you know, we know that he was no slouch on using pithy Anglo-Saxon expletives. You know, I could just imagine some of the language that he probably used in describing Lennon and how absolutely essential it was that Lennon, you know, be deported.
Or be silenced.
Or be silenced. Yeah, whatever. Yeah. One way or another. Yeah.
I guess, you know, you could take a look at it and say that this is Richard Nixon's, the silent majority's worst nightmare. The pot smoking, the incendiary speeches, the John Lennon things like that.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I mean, here's this guy mobilizing 20,000, you know, pot smokers, you know. And then what was it? 3 days later, Sinclair gets released from prison. It's like, holy crap. I mean, if you're Nixon, you got to think, holy crap. I mean, not only do they put on this concert, but they actually get this guy out of prison. Now, whether or not they got him out of prison is a moot point. You know, it appears. It appears. I mean, the circumstance of it, of his release coming just a few days later certainly makes it appear that the Chrysler Arena concert is this great success and that John Lennon, in fact, wields this enormous power, power that is so great that it can even change the justice system in a state like Michigan and get this radical, you know, screwing in the street, White Panther drug-smoking hippie out of prison. That's got to be your worst nightmare. It's got to be.
Now, the concert itself, some would say, it was certainly not a artistic success. It had its share of highlights, I suppose, but I hear that the speakers were not always, you know, welcomed.
No.
And that certain performers were not at their best. And certainly John's final performance was considered a huge disappointment by people expecting him to do a little I Want to Hold Your Hand.
Well, particularly if you wait until 3 in the morning.
Yeah.
You know, if you wait all that time and then John comes, you know, the act before John is David Peel. Mm-hmm. You know? And probably most of the dope smokers in the audience, you know, knew who David Peel was. But David Peel was still not a premium act. You know, he's out there, you know, singing his you know, Have a Marijuana, you know, acoustic instruments, washtub bass. You know, it's not a polished act at all. I mean, this is an act that performed on the streets of New York City, you know. So for him to be the lead-in act to John Lennon, you know, and then John comes out, you know, picks up an acoustic guitar, you know, and starts singing with Yoko. And I love Yoko. I do. I mean, while I was at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, I mean, I'll tell you the truth. You know, say what people say, Yoko Ono, as far as I'm concerned, is one of the nicest people that I met during my tenure at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. I think she's actually a very, very nice person. As far as being a great singer, you know, and I'm not a great singer either. So, you know, I think I'm qualified to say this. You know, Yoko is not, she's not a great singer. And even if she was, she's not a rock and roll singer. And like you said, people want to hear I Want to Hold Your Hand or Come Together or, you know,
Revolution,
something like that. And to come out and, you know, play a couple of folk songs, you know, The Luck of the Irish and whatever, and then strap on a national guitar and sing John Sinclair, which is a, it's an okay song. It's certainly not one of John's better songs. You know, you got to, 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 got to set him free. It's not what the crowd expected. It's not what the crowd expected. So, yeah, it had its high, it had its high points. Commander Cody and the Lost Planet Airmen, a University of Michigan band. You know, George Frame, you know, the piano player, Commander Cody, was a graduate student in art at the University of Michigan. Andy Stein, fiddle player and saxophone player, was studying classical violin at the UM School of Music. You know, and of course now he's part of the Guy's Shoe Band on Prairie Home Companion. You know, they played a real kick-ass set. You know, they were really good. Wonderful surprise performance by Stevie Wonder. Who knew? Stevie comes out. Wow, terrific, fantastic. You know, the band Up, which was basically an offshoot of the MC5, you know, they were okay. They, you know, but who knew who they were? They were nothing. Phil Oakes, co-founder of the Yippies, you know, with Jerry Rubin, comes out, does a wonderful set, but still, premium act, no. Pete Seeger, great presence. The people there weren't ready. They didn't want to see Pete Seeger, you know. So it was a real hodgepodge, a great hodgepodge of artists. In some ways, it reminded me a little bit of Bob Dylan's Rolling Thunder review. You know, because on do you remember that tour? Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, he had just all kinds of people, Bobby Newworth and Ramblin' Jack Elliott, mm-hmm. Just a whole cacophony of people. But you know, Chrysler, when you go to Chrysler Arena because John Lennon is putting on a concert, you expect a reasonable facsimile of the Beatles. Mm-hmm. And John wasn't going to give that to them.
He hadn't come. This was his first post-Beatles live performance, wasn't it?
Yes, it was.
Yeah.
In 5 years. That's a long time.
That's a long time.
That's a long time to be out of the public eye.
I do find it culturally – I mean, I wondered if you talk about kind of the cultural significance of Stevie Wonder appearing at the concert. Because, you know, Stevie was saying, I'm not a big supporter of – you know, I'm not a pot smoker. I'm not everything like that. But – this is wrong. This is wrong, and I have to stand up and be counted and like that. Is that also something that kind of gives this event a little bit of additional significance?
Well, of course, and Stevie being from Detroit, mm-hmm. you know, Stevie being part of the, he's a hometown boy. So he's you know, at the top of his game at that time. He's a hometown boy, and now I'm not sure. I have to think about it, but he might have been actually the only black musical performer.
Archie Shepp.
That's right. I'm sorry. Yeah, Archie Shepp was there. But Archie Shepp, you know, again, you know, a fantastic musician, unquestionably. But Archie Shepp. To the crowd at Chrysler Arena, who's Archie Shepp?
Yeah.
Stevie Wonder, at least they recognize. Mm-hmm. It was I think one of the major high points of the concert, and a cultural high point non-musically, because as you were saying, even though he doesn't believe in drug use, he understands that this is something very wrong, and so he's in keeping, you know, with the whole Martin Luther King tradition, because, you know, towards the end of his life, Martin Luther King was not just civil rights. He was anti-Vietnam. You know, he was anti so many things that crossed the political spectrum. I mean, he was standing up for the common man. He was no longer just the voice of civil rights. He was the voice of black people in any injustice. Mm-hmm. You know, the voice of whatever the injustice was. You know, this is what we needed to stand up for. He was broadening his message. He was saying, you know what, we do have to change. And people didn't understand that, I think, about Martin Luther King, because he wasn't necessarily changing his tactics. His tactics were still nonviolence and passive resistance. But he was changing his philosophical attitude to embrace whatever ills there are. You know, we need to stand together as brothers, black and white together. I'd be willing to bet that, you know, had he been alive, Martin Luther King, had he been asked, might have taken part in this, because he might have seen the injustice in the law that convicted Sinclair. So Wonder's presence was, in some ways, you know, maybe I'm romanticizing, but in some ways, maybe he was almost like a proxy representative of that tradition that Martin Luther King had started. That we need to stand together, you know, when there is an unjust law, mm-hmm. when there is an unjust war, when one, it's like in The Grapes of Wrath, mm-hmm. when Tom Joad is talking to his mother. You know, towards the end, and says, you know, when wherever there's a guy homeless, wherever there's a guy getting beat by a cop, wherever there's a guy who can't get a job, you know, and he goes on with this litany of injustices. He says, "I'll be there." You know, that's kind of like Stevie's role in this. You know, it's like he's the the Martin Luther King everyman who needs to stand by his brothers because there is an injustice. The other people, they have a political agenda. Mm-hmm. Stevie's agenda is more universal.
Mm-hmm. And this comes at a time when he was making the transformation from that typical Motown star to the guy who would produce things like Inner Visions and, you know, Superstition. And, you know, because he definitely made political statements in
absolutely.
The 70s. But I don't think he was quite at that point yet where he was
mode. He was just in the transitional period, you know, visions of inner visions, you know, living for the city, mm-hmm. you know, all that stuff is just like right there on the cusp, mm-hmm. you know. And I think that grew out of Martin Luther King's increasing, you know, acceptance of you can't just fight for civil rights. You got to fight for human rights mm-hmm. wherever they are. Mm-hmm. Wherever they are, you know, attacked, it's about human rights. Because if we just limit ourselves to civil rights, we're not going to get anywhere. We only get someplace if we fight for everybody's human rights. Mm-hmm. And so Stevie sees that, I think, and takes that and you know, maybe you're right. Maybe Chrysler Arena is like his first foray into really making that public. And then, like you said, he goes on to, you know, to all those amazing productions that come after that.
Mm-hmm. It probably is the first time or the only time that a Beatle and a Motown artist share a bill pre. I mean, I think they did back in the, you know, the early days.
Yeah, when the Beatles were first on tour.
Because and Motown, of course, was a huge, huge influence.
Look at how many Motown songs the Beatles
Twist
covered.
And Shout and Please, Mr. Postman and stuff like that.
Yeah, so, absolutely.
And of course, Peter Andrews tells a story that Lennon couldn't wait to go out to watch Wonder perform because he's my Beatles.
Yeah.
I don't know whether he actually even got to do it, but you know, it's interesting. Yeah, so I mean, it basically on its own, the concert itself can stand as a cultural touchstone, even though it never developed into something that its organizers hoped it would become.
Right. Yeah. Sure. It is, and you know, I'm so glad that you're doing this project because it is a moment in culture that has, unfortunately, you know, been kind of like shoved to the side. Not a lot of people remember that. Not a lot of people are aware of the significance that it had. You know, you ask people to, you know, to name who it, those people who even are aware of it. Ask them to name who performed there. You know, well, they'll say John Lennon. Maybe they'll say Stevie Wonder, but then, you know, as you start to go down the list, you know, they're going to lose it. They don't understand the magnitude of what this meant for Ann Arbor, for the University of Michigan, for the counterculture, for mainstream culture's reaction against the counterculture, as we were discussing, you know, because this really is something that scares the pants off Nixon and Hoover. It's really an incredibly seminal moment. It's like Monterey Pop Festival. You know, everybody talks about Woodstock. They talk about Woodstock and Altamont, you know, as being the great festivals. Well, you know, Woodstock wasn't about hippies. It was about all that music going mainstream. Mm-hmm. So Woodstock was really about the mainstreaming of the music. It wasn't about the counterculture. It was about the mainstreaming of the counterculture. Altamont was about the death of the counterculture. Monterey Pop, the festival that people don't talk about, the very first pop festival that there ever is. That to me is the one that has more cultural clout than either of the other two, even though the others are remembered with much greater fanfare.
And Monterey Pop also is much more cross-genre, isn't it?
Much
more. You have Otis Redding.
Ravi Shankar.
Yeah. I mean, you didn't have that kind of a thing at Woodstock. And of course, Woodstock if anything, didn't have any kind of political content. You have the famous moment where Pete Townsend
hits Abbie Hoffman on the head with the guitar, but
after he makes a statement telling people that, you know, Johnson Clare should be free.
Yeah, I mean, there were a few, you know, political moments, but they were the politics of consciousness, you know, about how, you know, when John Sebastian comes out and says, you know, oh, wow, man, you know, we're all, you know, groovy, and Arlo comes out and says, hey, man, you know, they shut down the freeway. This is like, he says, this is like the second largest city, you know, in the country or something like that. You know, and you can tell that they're all stoned out of their minds. I mean, it was more about the politics of consciousness. But getting back to the 10 for 2, you know, it was a really important touchstone concert that for whatever reason, you know, maybe it's because the film never really came out, you know, in a commercial market. Maybe it's because, you know, Lennon kind of abandoned his plans, you know, subsequent to that. But it's a concert that it's like a gestalt, you know, where the whole is greater than the sum of its parts. Chrysler Arena was really far greater than the sum of its parts, and people just don't realize that. They don't understand how much that moment, it was like an octopus. The tentacles went out in a lot of directions.
To learn more about the Free John Now rally, go to freeingjohnsinclair.org.
AADL Talks to Bruce Conforth has been a production of the Ann Arbor District Library.